For you, God, wouldn't it be so easy? They would see the young man's face pinking, and his hand reaching out for theirs. They would hear his voice calling through the satin and wood, asking them to help him up again. And they would slap him on the back with the gentle violence of men awkwardly trying to express their love. "You'd had us scared there for a minute, buddy. We thought we'd lost you," they would say, tears spilling over their cheeks. And he might reply, hugging them a little longer than he should, "I don't know what you did, but I'm so glad it worked." Chapter 4. Seasons. Tobin and I spent almost 10 years trying not to get pregnant because I was in school for a decade, and we were comically poor. Not poor like sweet church mice. Poor like people who worried we would get scurvy because we couldn't afford to buy oranges, and then got in the habit of talking about it using pirate voices. For a long time, we lived in a one-room apartment that the landlord generously called an efficiency. Tobin and I could reach into the kitchen from the living room couch, which was also the bed, and the desk. We would sit on our couch bed desk and watch late-night televangelism and movies we found in the student center and plan our next $5 date. We didn't mind deferring our dreams for a while, but then the demands of school and a $20,000 annual income started to make those decisions for us. We got in the habit of putting our child-rearing plans on hold for another day, a day when we would have a little house with a baby room and a decent cable package instead of an antenna. But by the time we could afford our own bungalow, we realized that getting pregnant was going to be harder than we imagined. A year went by, and then another, and we thought it might be too late. I made an appointment for us to meet with a fertility doctor, and immediately resented every bit of paperwork leading up to our first appointment. I would read the question aloud to Tobin and then exclaim, "This is none of their business." "It is literally their business," he replied. "Well, it shouldn't be," I huffed. I tried to resign myself to the indecency of it all, and I missed feeling like there were details of my life that medicine's expert ears would not hear. But I could not afford any privacy. We went to the doctor, and it was, as I had expected, poking and prodding and waiting. After a few appointments, Tobin and I were dawdling in the car outside the fertility center one day, counting babies. "I see absolutely zero babies," I said, after counting the first dozen or so women going in and out. "This must be a terrible repository for babies." "It's not a repository for babies," Tobin said, laughing. "This is for potentially making babies, in the least sexy way possible." I looked down at our hands, entwined on my knee. Our doctor, Dr. Gandhi, was exhaustingly clinical. But as he started to rattle off our treatment options, he reminded me of my high school friend Ankita's dad, who used to look down at us through his spectacles and quiz us about trouble we might be up to as if it were 1965. "Have you been joyriding, girls? Have you been necking with boys at the drive-in pictures?" The trick was to look at his glasses and not in his eyes, so you didn't burst out laughing. Dr. Gandhi was looking at me, a little disappointed, but I wasn't sure why. I didn't think the charts he gave us were particularly definitive about the problem, and the solutions were a hazy mix of needles and pills and indefinite periods of waiting. He recommended delaying any treatment and suggested that we keep an eye on hormone levels for a few months to further diagnose the problem. But the waiting was pulling me down and backward into those feelings, familiar from months of trying to solve the mystery of my arms, of exhausted unknowing. I was already tired of doctors. I was tired of waiting. I was tired of keeping my dreams on a tight leash. For the next few months, I managed the disappointment of no result with prayer and cookie dough and long periods of lying silently in the crook of Tobin's arm. He'd wrap his arms around me, and we'd stare at the botched drywall experiment that became the ceiling in the bungalow we rebuilt with our love and our religious determination that all construction work should be done by family members. I had never noticed how much prosperity churches talk about waiting until I began this long season of maternal deferment. I had never noticed how many women were pushing strollers and jostling babies with smooshy cheeks until I had to regularly stand up and sing a Sunday favorite by Juanita Bynum. I don't mind waiting. I don't mind waiting. I don't mind waiting on you, Lord. She draws out the word like she has forever to wait, forever to sit with a merciful God, forever to hear God finally say, "It's time. It's time." Waiting is the language of Ecclesiastes. To everything there is a season and a time to every purpose under heaven. Except that the prosperity gospel usually makes believers into farmers with seed faith sown in the ground, sitting in church, waiting for the rain and the harvest. One Sunday, I watched a woman grow so impatient that she called down the rain. It was the first lady of the little prosperity church I studied, a slight woman who always sat in the front row, impassively fanning herself as her husband stirred up a fiery sermon. Then, one Sunday, she suddenly stood up and turned toward the congregation. "Our faith requires action," she declared with surprising strength. "We must see disease, poverty, and unanswered prayers for what they are, Satan's work. Now stand up, stand up." The small room shuffled to stand up, murmuring with excitement. "Now, after I say, 'Money cometh unto me,' you call out to God for what you are entitled to. God's blessings are already poured out for you. Now you must claim them. Claim them. Are you ready?" "Yes." "Money," she shouted. "Now say it with me. Money cometh unto me now." And with that, the first lady began to dance. She kicked her high heels under a chair and bounced in place, reaching her arms higher and higher as she plucked invisible dollar bills from the sky. The room erupted into dance as some 80 believers, young and old, shook off their nerves and slowly joined her. It started as a murmur, as people began to speak their true hearts, and grew as their legs pumped in place and people began to shout, "A car! The greenhouse!" They reached out for blessings visible only to them. Young mothers jostled their babies as they jumped, while elderly women waved their arms to catch what fell. Tears streamed down people's faces as they dug up their deepest desires and the losses they hoped to replace. A husband and wife who had lost all of their children simply clutched each other with one arm each and the other reached up to the sky. "A baby," I said quietly, as the shouting faded and people slumped back into their seats, exhausted. "A baby." In this season of endless postponement, Chelsea and I were so happy for other people that we were exhausted. We were so happy for Amanda that her husband made so much money in whiskey sales that she could stay at home or find the most flattering angle for her selfies whenever she was sunning herself on tropical vacations. We were thrilled for Joanna that her family planning went off without a hitch, and she gave birth to little Cade on exactly the day she wanted. We couldn't get enough of hearing Christine talk about the pounds flying off as she really put her mind to it. "Self-discipline, girls," she said, and we sucked our stomachs in a little more. In fact, we were getting so good at being happy for people that we started to develop a special tone of voice, which sounded a little like a valley girl on helium, for people who couldn't stop telling us how easily they had found their place in the sun. Whenever I found myself saying something like, "And then you went backstage with the band again?" I reminded myself to pull out the statement, "I'm so happy for you." It was deliciously insincere, but only Chelsea knew that, and it was a balm to my soul. I was surrounded by the world's luckiest people in a culture that doesn't believe in luck. Oprah Winfrey is a one-woman crusade against luck. "Nothing about my life is lucky," she has argued. "Nothing. A lot of grace, a lot of blessings, a lot of divine order, but I don't believe in luck. For me, luck is preparation, meeting the moment of opportunity." Luck implies that there might have been a moment when, God forbid, good fortune might have gone next door. Luck might mean we cannot say, unbowed, with the poet William Ernest Henley, "I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul." Nothing in me wanted to take anything away from the people I loved, but I was becoming more and more like Solomon in Ecclesiastes, pulling at dark threads. There is a time to get and a time to lose, a time to rend and a time to sow. But at baby showers and dinners for job promotions, I listened to the tradition anew. There is a time to speak and a time to shut your pie hole. I believed in magic once. I was playing bingo with my friends in the monstrous bingo hall of an equally monstrous casino, its tall domes studded with artificial lights, making night and day indistinguishable. There were hundreds of players in little terraces that spread down to the floor, where a man plucked numbered balls out of what looked like a giant popcorn machine. My friends and I were high rollers, each armed with a pink dabber to blot out the numbers and a $3 bingo card on which a single person could play not one but six whole games. We played the first game, then the second, slowly gaining confidence in the pace and the rules. The winner of the first game was the first person to play a horizontal line. The winner of the second game was the first person to fill the square around the central numbers, and so on. But then the grand finale, blackout. The first person to blot out the entire card would win $1,300, the biggest cash prize of the night. I was roughly three numbers away from winning when I began silently to pray a completely absurd prayer. "Dear Jesus," I thought, totally embarrassed, "I know you don't normally do this kind of thing, and that it would be dumb if you did, but we are really broke right now, and I would love to win that money. So, if you wouldn't mind, could you help me win at bingo?" I shouted it so loudly that I startled the woman next to me. "Bingo!" I yelled again. But then, seeing everyone's heads slowly turn toward me, I had a moment of doubt. But I could be wrong! But I was right. The officiant came over with great fanfare, carrying $100 bills that he arranged in a flat pyramid in front of me and my friends, who cried with laughter after I recounted my prayer. I had prayed to God like he was a candy dispenser, and it had worked. We were converted. I used the same words a few months later when I was locked in the bathroom holding a pregnancy test. I still hadn't had any fertility treatments, but even so, my body seemed to be working. I took one, two, then three positive pregnancy tests. Then I shouted through the door, unable to look at Tobin and see the expectation in his eyes. "I'm pregnant," I yelled, trying to keep my voice as flat as possible. Silence. but I could be wrong. I could hear him laughing through the door. How can you be wrong, hon? Are those tests not very accurate? He asked reasonably. And what are you still doing in there? I was lying on the floor, effectively barricading myself in with my feet against the door. I couldn't face it. I couldn't face him. I felt like the moment I saw him, everything would be real. Thank God the phone was in there with me. I dialed Chelsea's number, choked up by the impossible news. If magic was about formulas and saying the right words, I knew this wasn't magic. It was something else. Chelsea, you wouldn't believe it, but I think I finally got lucky. I thought about what I had said a second too late, and we laughed so hard we had to put our phones down for a minute to retie our ponytails. My body, as it turned out, was not nearly as eager to bear a child as my mind was. Pregnancy hormones were loosening me up at every joint, already lax from the same condition that had caused me to feel heaviness and numbness in my arms. I was a jellyfish. As the pregnancy progressed and my hips softened, my belly hung off my ligaments like lead. The baby was safe and snug, but it was literally pulling me apart. Week by week, I spent more and more time in the bathtub, floating. I slowly hoisted myself out of bed in the morning and taught classes to divinity school students all day. I teetered on my shoes in the morning, and by midday, I plopped myself on a table or a chair and taught almost face-to-face with the class. I tried to be relatable and fun, but mostly I tried to pretend that pregnancy was an uncomplicated blessing. It was a healthy pregnancy by every standard, except that I wanted to put myself in a light coma until sometime after the baby was born. Please, anyone, surprise me with a baseball bat to the head. The pain was a dull roar. At a faculty dinner, I looked up and realized that someone had been talking to me for quite a while. I'm so sorry, I said, blushing. This baby is just so loud. People kept telling me, oh, you wait until the baby is born, then you'll see how hard it is. And I wish now they could have seen the look on my face when I finally went into labor. Deep into the rhythm of arduous contractions, I found myself smiling. This is nice, I panted to my sister-in-law over the phone. Seriously, this feels so much better. When we arrived at the hospital, a day into hard labor that wouldn't progress, the doctor looked me up and down and suggested that we return home again. You don't have the look of someone in labor, she said matter-of-factly. Yeah, well, you're gonna wanna check me. I am, unfortunately, amazing at being miserable. I had one of those deliveries that mothers shouldn't talk about because the world would, in an instant, stop having children altogether. All I will say is that my labor lasted 37 hours, and at many points, it was without the soothing comforts of modern medicine. But when the baby continued to go into distress, his heartbeat fluttering on the beeping monitor, the doctors decided it was time for a C-section. And many hours after they made that call, he was pulled from my body and placed into my arms. As someone who has never had overly mushy feelings about babies, I have to say it was the most bizarre feeling I had ever had. It felt like something had pushed the reset button and my life had only begun. I should have asked for a birth certificate for myself. What followed was a blissful year. That is the most annoying thing in the world to say. in a world full of mothers who struggle with breastfeeding, high fevers, long days, and late nights. But I can only try to redeem myself by saying that I was completely caught off guard by my outrageous happiness. I had a Zach, and a Zach suited me perfectly. He smelled like vanilla extract and cookies almost all the time. And when he didn't, I sat him on a puffy, waterproof cushion shaped like a frog in warm water in our farmhouse sink. Baby Zach looked a lot like a guppy staring at me with wide, expressive eyes. He was hard to feed, hard to entertain, hard to put down to bed. Every time he wanted to relax, he demanded a brainstem-loosening jiggle of his whole body up and down, in order to chill out for a moment and close his eyes. Some of the photos I circulated of Zach made him look like a wizened librarian with a comb-over, his thick cardigan pulled up around his neck. But I looked at him with the delusional love of a mother who knew he was going to be beautiful. And he was. My first book on the prosperity gospel, My Other Baby, had come out only months before Zach was born, so I spent this time in that sweet post-book haze that scholars love so much. The book is out in the world, looking important and busy, while you are at home in your pajamas eating pizza. I was wrapped in a cocoon of my husband's love, my son's squawking, and the glorious facade of efficiency. On my 34th birthday, I could finally admit it to myself. I sent a thank you to all my family and friends with a little picture of Zach, perched on his little frog in the sink, his hair sprouting up from his head like an antenna. It read, "Contrary to reports that 33, the Jesus year, must end badly, this was officially the best year of my life. And if anyone is a notary, we can make it official. Thanks for supporting me until I got to this, my own little prosperity gospel." My 150-person American Christianity class caught wind of the note and sent me a giant gift basket filled with onesies and t-shirts for Zach, plastered with enormous lettering that said it all. Blessed. Chapter 5. Surrender. Jonathan and Beth, bearing away my dress, have been gone for hours, and now I lie in the hospital bed waiting for my surgery. I'm counting up my time and realizing it will not be enough, and I long for that God of yes. I keep thinking, I am 35. I will not live out the year, and this time will not be enough. It will not be sufficient to raise a little baby to adulthood. It will not be the life that I promised to my husband. It is a poor imitation of the future I had planned. Lord, take this cancer away. Save me. Let me be a wife and mom and professor who loves you and lives to tell of your glory. I am bargaining. I am trying to find the magic formula that lifts me out of this sterile room and back to the warmth of my own bed and the sound of Zach babbling over the baby monitor about mama and tractors. But mostly tractors. God, let me stay the mom of a boy who loves tractors. Everything feels strange and slow. On pain medication and without clocks, I can't say for sure if it is still the same day as my diagnosis, the day of my surgery, or if they are one and the same. The first indication I have that it has been 2 days since my diagnosis is that the church is keeping vigil. This will turn out to be one of the great advantages of working at Duke Divinity School. All of my friends are pastors. My colleagues teach pastors, my friends are pastors, and my students are going to be pastors. There is a flood of pastors, not only in my room, but in the nearby waiting room, and in the Divinity School's own chapel, where the community has decided to come together and pray me through my surgery. They gathered in the warm wood sanctuary and sang hymns and read scripture and prayed thick, layered prayers in a way that only desperate people can. When the service ended, they came to the hospital and traded off like relay runners, each praying for me until relieved. Some are close friends, and some are acquaintances, and most are much, much smarter than I am. So it pleases me to no end to find out later that the most serious scholars I have ever known, authors of weighty books and owners of many velvet-smoking jackets, have cried snotty tears as they pleaded with God to extend my life. They are teaching me the first lesson of my new cancer life. The first thing to go is pride. The moments before I go into surgery are, comedically speaking, always a real high point for me. Over the course of my life, some of my best material has been in those pre-operating table moments, where nurses are clucking around me and a hotshot doctor is giving instructions. Before my wisdom teeth were removed, with a few drugs, okay, a lot of drugs, I grabbed someone by the collar and told them to keep the teeth. I was making a necklace for Tobin. Before my emergency appendix removal, I had some solid remarks about minimizing scars for the swimsuit portion of the Miss Canada contest. So when I tell the nurses this time that I'm finally going to hit my goal weight when this giant tumor is cut out of my colon, it gets a big response. But then I follow it up with what I have really wanted to say since I fought with this doctor about my stomach pain. When I yelled, "I'm not going back out there with everyone else," and he had rolled his eyes. He is standing beside me now, and I grab his arm, pull him toward me, and say in a low, serious voice, "I had better not die looking into your eyes." The nurses roar. I have mentally decided that when the Lifetime movie version of my life is made, the doctor will be played by Matthew McConaughey, with firm instructions to always chew gum and be looking into the middle distance just past me. And I am Winona Ryder, and 1,000 emotions will always flit over my perfect face. The doctor will actually make another miracle for me, so audiences will have to grow to love him. The surgery has taken 4 hours instead of 2, and the waiting room, filled to the brim with my friends, my colleagues, and my dad, who won't stop pacing, is sunk low with the speculation that something has gone very wrong. Instead, the doctor has taken the extra time to sew me back together instead of giving me a colostomy bag. He didn't have to. An hour or so before the surgery, a woman with a very calming voice had stopped by with a giant plastic bag and told me that I would be, well, going to the bathroom out of a hole in my stomach for the foreseeable future, but not to worry, a lot of celebrities have them. And I said something deep like, "Sure." Because at the time, I didn't think I'd make it through the night anyway. The way the doctors are delicately picking up and handling the words, stage 4, suggests that I am a spaghetti bowl of cancer. And, oddly, this reality has filled me with love. Love for my son. Love for my friends and family. Love for my husband sitting beside me, squeezing my hand moments before the surgery. "This is proof," he says, "even though I never questioned it, but the way you look at me." He stops. He can't say any more, but he knows, I hope he knows, that I have loved him since he was 15 and put bleach spray in his blonde hair to make it even blonder and wore purple tank tops that should never be spoken of. He is the reason that, when he leaves me for a moment, I call Chelsea and my sister-in-law and give them instructions in an artificially determined voice. "You have to promise me that you will tell him to get remarried. I don't want this to be the end of both our lives. By the time I have reached the words, Zach needs a mom. I can't say any more, and they can't hear any more. They want to hear that I will fight and pull myself back from the edge. I want to hear that it is settled, that my life and my love will not undo each other. I couldn't sleep last night, and I spent the hours alone, awake, thinking through questions that are useless to me now. Why did the doctors keep sending me home in pain all summer? How could the ER doctor give me antacids and tell me that people come in with all manner of stubbed toes and little things these days? I spent the summer with bright pink Pepto-Bismol in my purse and waves of stomach pain that left me gasping. And after all that, I got the second least sexy cancer, colon cancer. At least it's not rectal cancer. But I wake up after surgery, surprised, pleased. As I'm rolled through the hallways from the operating room, I see another good friend, Chad, who drove all night from Alabama to stand beside Tobin with an encouraging smile on his face. "Oh, buddy," I apparently say to him. "Of course you're here. That is so nice. And you look so skinny." It is the first of many things I tell people when I am on drugs, because drugged Kate has a lot of feelings and opinions about how people should live their lives. Mostly I try to tell my friends and family how much they mean to me, but end up saying that and more. A few hours later, I am sitting with a beloved friend. "Oh, my dear one, it's time. It's time to go. You can leave your career. Yes, it's still undone. The work here is still undone. But if you stay here, a bitterness is going to eat up everything I love about you. If you don't go, I will hate you forever." I say that last bit to make him laugh, because my hand is on his head and tears are trickling down both our faces. He is getting older, but he will leave town not long after this and start life over someplace new. Later, just knowing that he is happy, that people I adore can restart their lives, glues something inside of me back together. A colleague is sitting beside me, and I am, for a reason I can't later remember, telling him what to do. "You can't be happy unless you forgive them and set them aside. There is no way around it, buddy. You have to forgive." My friend is stuck, but if he were unstuck, oh, he would conquer the world. But first he must stop carrying the weight of disappointment and comparison. I don't know why I never said that before. I save my most terrible love for Chelsea, my rock, my friendship twin. The nurses are changing my bandages, and I have my phone pressed hot against my ear. Chelsea and I are trying to talk, but there's too much to say. "I think I'm running out of time, honey," I say finally. "I'm not trying to be dramatic, but here's what I worry about. What if you are too?" She knows what I'm saying. She's working harder than anyone I have ever known, but her selflessness has caused her to surrender too much of herself to someday. And now someday has come, at least for me. Whenever I have fallen apart, she has reassembled the pieces. I know she wants to reach through the phone and pull me back into our bubble, where one of us cries and the other diagnoses the problem with merciless affection. "I have to go," I say finally. "I've got to adjust my meds." But we just sit there, clinging to goodbye, before I say at last, "Go live your life, Chels." All these words I am tripping over are benedictions. Live unburdened. Live free. Live without forevers that don't always come. These are my best hopes for you, that you press forward at last. I don't know how to die. but I know how to press this crushing grief into hope. Hope for them. It doesn't sound much like goodbye. It sounds more like this. Fare thee well, my loves. People come to my bedside in the hospital, but then they go, and the beep, beep, beep of the heart rate monitor remains. This is the most alone I've ever been. I grew up surrounded by communities of Mennonites, and you're never alone when you're with them. Mennonites are people with the land in their blood and a hopeless obsession with simplicity, frugality, pacifism, and jello salads. I'm not Mennonite by birth, but I attended a Mennonite church, a Mennonite Bible camp, and a Mennonite wedding, my own. I married a gorgeous, square-jawed Mennonite boy when both of us were practically teenagers, and he was still mildly enchanted by my propensity for spontaneous song. But a Mennonite marriage was a rich inheritance, as I acquired enough people to fill an entire basement of folding tables covered in turkey and jiggling salads for Thanksgiving. The best and worst parts of Mennonite culture stem from the fact that it is an exclusive club. Since they typically immigrated to the United States and Canada in huge waves, often from the same communities in southern Russia, all Mennonites come from the same stock. Where I grew up, they have one of 20 exciting last names to choose from. Duick, Lepke, Penner, Barkman, Friesen, etc. I was often a bridesmaid in a Friesen-Friesen wedding, and even at my own wedding rehearsal, when I asked for Mark Penner to come up to the front, 3 people stood up. Most people are born into the tribe, and, though science has not yet proven it, I'm pretty sure they are genetically predisposed to singing in 4-part harmony and making thick braided breads and homemade jam. Mennonite land was also the best place on earth to find a boyfriend. But the part I miss right now is how wonderful they are at suffering together. Every Mennonite family is the bearer of a sad history kept in living memory. They make time to tell the kids about the first Canadian winters endured by their great-grandparents, and proudly display a massive coffee table version of a book called Martyr's Mirror from the 1600s, which catalogs the grisly deaths of their ancestors. Perhaps that is the most oddly comforting thing about joining the Mennonite Club. They insist that suffering never be done alone. People tell stories about our suffering, our town, our community. When some Mennonite factions objected to, say, English language instruction in the classroom, whole communities uprooted and moved together to a new place to start afresh. They might be the most quarrelsome group I have ever studied. I once read an entire year's worth of debates over the continued use of a hymnal they already liked. But I love their goal. Unanimity. They will live and die together. I am starting to worry that I will die here, apart, away from my home among the Mennonites of Canada, away from that delicious feeling of being folded into something. It was a feeling that began for me at Thanksgiving years ago, when I saw that Tobin's Grandma Penner had put my name in black ink on a little place card on my plate. Tobin and I were only dating, but there I was, written into their lives on a note card she kept year after year. Suddenly, the house seemed alive. I could hear the gentle ribbing of the men comparing notes on cars they had wrecked, and see Tobin's aunts, cousins, and sisters setting down a dozen pies on the ping-pong table. Grandma Penner called me over and, with her wrinkled hands, showed me how to roll the buns into thick, pull-apart sheets. After we all sat down to the folding tables and sang the doxology, one of the young wives of a second cousin looked at my place card. "Pen, huh?" she asked wryly. I smiled. "That's fantastic," she said with a laugh. "You're in." My grandma took one look at my brother's girlfriend and whispered to me, "Let's put this one down in pencil." but not everything can be done together. Tobin is sitting beside me on the hospital bed, and I'm trying to explain it to him. The way that everyone acts like one day I will fly away. A new pair of wings will suddenly sprout on my back, and my feet will lift off the ground. I will wave goodbye as I'm taken up, up into the clouds. It's not like that, I tell Tobin. I will not fly away. Tobin is looking at me with that studied expression he gets when he doesn't understand, but he knows it is the wrong time to ask a question. He leans toward me and takes both my hands. I will not fly away, I repeat, my speech garbled with emotion. I keep thinking about this boy I heard about, a teenage boy in his final days of dying from cancer. He kept choking until his doctor finally figured out what he wanted. He wanted one last hard cry, but his lungs were so filled with fluid that he couldn't catch his breath. So the nurses were called, and they managed to slowly drain his lungs so the boy could sob until that one horrible and satisfying full stop. I don't know how to explain it, Tobin. It's like we're all floating on the ocean, holding onto our own inner tubes. We're all floating around, but people don't seem to know that we're all sinking. Some are sinking faster than others, but we're all sinking. I keep having the same unkind thought. I am preparing for death, and everyone else is on Instagram. I know that's not fair, that life is hard for everyone, but I sometimes feel like I'm the only one in the world who is dying. We are all sinking, slowly, but one day, while everyone watches, I will run out of air. I am going to go under. Even explaining it, I feel more and more frantic. There will be a day when I can't take my next breath, and I will drown. I can picture it so clearly. People talk about heaven like it's a hop, a skip, and a jump. A veil between heaven and earth will part, and I will pass through it. The promise of heaven to me is this. Someday, I will get a new set of lungs, and I will swim away. But first, I will drown. Every morning, I live the same moment. I can hear Zach over the baby monitor, squawking and mewing, and murmuring the first words. Mama, Papa, Dadu, which, roughly translated, mean Mother, Father, Tractor, save me from this prison. It used to be the beginning of my favorite part of the day. I wake to the sounds of my son, and as I lift him out of his crib, warm milk waiting beside the change table, I have reinvented the world. I have rescued 20 pounds of chubby arms, legs, and cheeks, and set them free to move about the house to identify toy tractors and bring fleece onesies back into fashion. Ever since the diagnosis, there has been a moment, in the minute between sleeping and waking, when I forget. When I have only a lingering sense that there is something I am supposed to remember. In the warmth of my bed, I am caught in webs of dreams. And then there is the flood. I am dying. I am dying. I am my son's first goodbye. I am not the start of a great new day. I am a bright sunset. And then one day, I have cancer in my dreams. I am looking into the window of a perfectly average home to see another woman set the table and stoop to pick up my son. I am on a boat caught in the storm, and I say to the crew in a bright voice, "Don't worry about me. I was already going to die." I say it with such certainty, impervious to the weight of it and the sound it makes on my lips. But in the day, the real day, I am beginning to notice the expansion of this grief. My friends bear the brunt of my honesty. Chelsea starts to receive all my passwords and firm instructions about how my work should be handled. Lacey learns where all the diaries are kept that I would rather not leave for posterity. The diary of 12-year-old Kate will be allowed to remain, because it is a daily account of what a boy named Colin was doing, and I am convinced that if Colin committed a crime in 1992 and is later put on trial, my diary is so thorough that it would either convict or exonerate him. I have been back from the hospital after surgery for 2 weeks, and I am slowly trying to move around, but mostly sitting in every chair. So, naturally, I begin to conscript my family and whoever happens to be visiting to bring me all my books from around the house. I'm trying to decide what I can read in the time I have left. Then I give the rejects away or get my laptop and start to list them online. I spend hours on this self-appointed project, and I force my dad and my friends to sit there with me, squinting at the fine print in the first few pages of every book to find the barcodes and the ISBN numbers. My mom used to call this approach the giant mitts for the way that I can slowly squeeze people into doing what I want them to do. She meant it in a nice way, something about a happy, fluffy kind of leadership. But looking at my assembly line of workers, each behind a pile of books so high I can barely see them, I am beginning to see who I still am. I am a well-oiled machine of perfect efficiency. We do this for hours and late into the night. "Why would Tobin want all these books?" I ask them. "These books have always been my hobby, my thing. Wouldn't it be awful for him to have to sort through these hundreds of books?" "Life is a series of losses," says my father-in-law one afternoon. We are sitting outside on the patio, where I always sit now, wrapped to my eyeballs in blankets and looking at the sky. There is something about a ceilingless world, the slow drift of clouds, and the sound of birds that staves off the taste of fear. "What, Dad?" I love calling him Dad. He has earned it with his gentle, fix-it nature and his willingness to braid my hair on camping trips. "Oh, I was just thinking about how, with age, it is one loss after another," he replies. "Huh. He's right. With age, we slowly lose our senses and even our pleasures. Our parents, and then our friends, preparing us for our own absence." "An interesting thought." "First, there was racquetball," he says suddenly, jolting me back into the present. "What? I had to give up racquetball in my 50s. "That's not exactly the kind of thing I'm worried about right now," I yell with mock rage. He laughs and then spends the next half hour trying to remake his point until I demand that he never repeat it again and that we get coffee and a biscuit, because my habits are increasingly geriatric. Lord, save me from old people. It will become a constant refrain with my older friends that the moment one of them starts to complain about an aching hip, all the rest will slowly turn and look for my response. And I will not disappoint them. "I'm sorry," I sympathize, my voice thick with sarcasm. "Is your long life becoming an encumbrance?" They are always full professors with endowed chairs and weighty accomplishments, so I suspect that they have not been properly made fun of before. But they are becoming some of my closest friends. We can sit on the same bench, quietly wondering what to do with this unwinding clock. I have started writing letters to Zach in the quiet between naps, hospital visits, and my earnest sister-in-law fussing over how to get me to eat. Zach can sit on the bed with me, but mostly he wants to roll around, and he can't touch the tender stitches across my stomach. Not touching him is exhausting. Time has started to feel like it's getting away from us. When he gets older, will he know how I felt the moment they put him in my arms? There was nothing like it, Zach. The nurses said that when our eyes met, I kept repeating, "It was you. It was you the whole time." I used to think that grief was about looking backward. Old men saddled with regrets, or young ones pondering should-haves. I see now that it is about eyes squinting through tears into an unbearable future. The world cannot be remade by the sheer force of love. A brutal world demands capitulation to what seems impossible. Separation. Brokenness. An end without an ending. It is one thing to abandon vices and false starts and broken relationships. I have tried to scrounge around in my life for things to improve, sins to repent of, things to give God to say, "There, I gave it all." But it is something else entirely to surrender my family. Three links in a chain. It is not mine to give. I can see the hunger in my husband's eyes as I pause for a moment at our son's crib. He is watching me as if I am fading into gray. I meet his eyes because it is all I can do. I can be gentle with that man, keep my tone soft, tuck the blankets around his bare, muscled shoulders as he falls asleep. I can try to communicate, "I know, I know. The water is rising and the levees may break and it will sweep us all away. But until then, I am here. I will not let go." I once stumbled into a prosperity megachurch expecting to find a regular service, but instead found a funeral. I picked up the bulletin and saw a famous face staring back at me from the cover, smiling as he always did. I had considered him to be a kind and straightforward sort of preacher, happy to guarantee healing and prosperity because he believed in God's abundant provision with his whole heart. But he died in middle age, surrounded by people, well-meaning people, clawing for the meaning of his death. Even the bulletin had to include a separate section to address the question on everyone's minds. Why? Did he lack faith? Did he fail to live out his own teachings? In a theological universe in which everything you do comes back to you like a boomerang, for good or for ill, those who die young become hypocrites or failures. Those loved and lost are just that, those who have lost the test of faith. I have heard countless stories of denial in the face of death. A pastor stops a funeral to try to resurrect a young boy being put into the ground. A woman in the hospital hears her diagnosis and refuses treatment because she believes God will heal her, growing frail as her family watches in desperation. A famous healer dies after using his own ulcerated leg as a litmus test for his faith. The United States Postal Service asks a prosperity preacher to cease claiming the power to resurrect the dead. Desperate families have stopped up the flow of mail to his headquarters with coffins. But mostly I see people who refuse to allow their loved ones to grow weary. In the waiting room, a daughter asks her elderly mother to put on her lipstick and smile before seeing the doctor. A man I know wants to call it quits on his painful gauntlet of medical treatments, but he can't bear the disappointment of his family. My nurse keeps saying, "But at least you're here now," when reviewing the boxes I have checked on the form she has given me. Fatigue, insomnia, pain, depression. There are no words that don't sound like surrender. There must be rhythms to grief, but I do not know them. people begin to take their turns grieving me because it can't be done all at once. Family and friends who could not be at the hospital for my operation come to stay at the house, and we start all over at the beginning. I sit outside, wrapped in the same blankets and taking in the sunshine, all my favorite people orbiting around me. My pastor takes out her psalms and reads a little, gripping my hand. My mom cooks a lot, stocking the freezer with everything that is suggested to be anti-cancer. My older sister Amy sends treats and constant encouragement, while Maria, my younger sister, gives me her words when she can't be there, sending me poems and little bits of trivia from New York, where she is working as an editor for a Catholic magazine. She has two big hopes for me. One, that I will be cured. The other, that, before it is over, I will punch the nearest inconsiderate person in the face. I have so many fears, spoken and unspoken. When I first got my job at Duke and realized that I was going to live in the United States for some time, I made a lot of loud protestations about how I will not die in a foreign land. I also made clear that I would not die in my office, not only because that had happened before to professors, prone as they are to get preoccupied by their research, but also because it seemed sad, at 29, to feel exiled to the land of opportunity for eternity. I think back on how I casually strategized about where I would be buried, concerned that I would never be able to reconcile all the parts of my identity. A daughter who lives far from family, a friend who spends too much time at work, a wanderer but a type A planner. I wondered if I would ever be one whole person. But now I am not hoping for completeness of any kind. All I can think of are the logistics. One night I wake up almost every hour because my mind has seized on a horrible question. Wouldn't it be a paperwork nightmare to move my body? To take me home? When I teach pastors at the seminary where I work, I lecture them about the First Great Awakening and religious responses to the Civil War, and how their political differences will ruin their next Thanksgiving if they don't learn to shut their traps. But as a historian, I have never spent any time teaching them how to perform baptisms, officiate weddings, or conduct funerals. And I have certainly never told them what to say when they visit someone who is dying, and how not to sit on her couch, mouthful of cookies, and ask endless questions about how cancer treatment works. I did not tell them how few of their words are needed, but how much their hands are wanted. A hand on my back as I tear up. A hand on my head for a soft prayer for healing. When I feel I am fading away, these hands prop me up and make me new. When my older colleague Frank, who lost his own adult son, found his way into my hospital room, he wrapped his strong hands around mine and said, quietly, "I wore this clerical collar to impress you, and also to get through hospital security." The prosperity gospel understands the power of touch perhaps better than anyone, except maybe Catholics, who are always making everything into something you can run through your fingers or, if it's bolted to the floor, at least take worshipful pictures next to. But prosperity believers run a close second. The earliest prosperity preachers were tent revivalists who used to get down into the crowd at the pinnacle of the service, rolling up their sleeves to lay their hands on the heads and limbs of trembling believers. And when they retired a tent, because the audiences were either too large or too small, the enterprising preachers would cut these canvas cathedrals into little squares to mail to supporters. The fabric ostensibly saturated with healing power that people could hold in their hands. When Oral Roberts, famous televangelist and founder of the first charismatic university, wanted to help at-home audiences to believe. He used to raise his right hand to the camera so viewers could press their hands against the screen. The next best thing to skin on skin. They called these things points of contact, the mediation of sacred power through